This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collett. Welcome to The First Time.
Kate, let's catch up. You are everywhere.
Well, I mean, the hilarious thing, Catherine, is, you say that I'm everywhere, and yet both of us still
That's true.
Our own little houses. I'm still looking at you in your milk room there. Still looking at me in here.
I need a better backdrop. God, I need to work on my backdrop. I feel like everyone is going to be so... when designing a desk space, it was what the person who used the desk could see. But now it's like it's so much more voyeuristic.
Exactly. What's behind you? Which books should I put on what? Someone sent me a message the other day on something. They'd obviously taken it a screenshot and then zoomed right in. And they were like, Alice Munro collection. And I'm like, the Alice Munro collection is like right up there. Like I don't even.
Wow.
But I mean, I obviously do exactly the same thing, so I'm not judging.
So what's the last fortnight been like? Motherfault's been in the world 3 weeks now.
It has. I'm rapidly running out of my six-week time frame, aren't I? It's been quite the roller coaster. Do you know how we talk about it all the time and we like talk to writers and we say, isn't it a roller coaster and good luck with a roller coaster? I forgot. I forgot that it actually was, that like some nights are – I don't think we've recorded since this, but I got the phone call on a Thursday night. It was like you could sense spring and the end of lockdown. And my publisher calls me to say, it was on day eight. I remember that. It was on day eight. And she rings to say, we're reprinting. Like, bang, we're reprinting. And I was like, holy hell. I poured champagne. I was like, I will never ask for anything else in my entire life. Like, this is it. This is the pinnacle. I've done all I need to do on this good earth.
That's awesome.
Like 4 days later, curled up in bed like, oh, God, I'm a terrible person. Like,
why are we so, like, externally influenced? Like, pendulum swings from such massive highs to such despairing lows.
I don't know. I think, I think that we also go searching for it, because then I did put on Twitter, people will have seen if they are also on Twitter and listeners, that I was like, mate, I looked at Goodreads. And like, Catherine, how many times have you messaged me and I'm like, get off Goodreads. Like, what are you doing? You fool, get off Goodreads. I know the rule. I know Goodreads is not for us. I know that. Why did I go searching?
I'm shaking my head at you. I know the compulsion, but it's such a self-flagellation. Like it's really putting on a hair vest, because you actually knowingly know where it's, because you're not going on there to go, oh, where's a 5-star review?
No, show me the ones you
choose.
Show me the person who said it was unrelatable. Show me who said I didn't do my world building good enough. Go on, show me.
Oh, they're assholes.
Anyway,
special moments have stood out so far.
Special moments. I had one last night. I had a really lovely event last night, which was a book club for Yarra Valley Writers Festival. And it was nice too, because it was with Michael Veitch and Brooke Powell. And, I interviewed Michael for the Apollo Bay Festival. So that was kind of nice. But he read some, he asked during it, he said, oh, can I read this section out? And it was so lovely. And it was so lovely for someone like, I can't deal. I haven't listened to the audiobook. I can't normally listen. I can't bear really to read it out myself. Yet having him kind of surprise
you're a big – oh, he read yours.
He read my – yeah.
That's
he
gorgeous.
He read a section of the book out and I was really overwhelmed by it. Like, it was really lovely. So that kind of thing
– that's gorgeous.
Yeah. That kind of thing has been really nice. Like when people or a friend said,
what's fascinating about that too is not only hearing your own words, but which words.
Oh my gosh.
So was his selection interesting?
He did too. He picked like really key scene on the boat, which I imagined he might, because I knew that he's done boating things before. And he picked a section about motherhood, which was Yeah, it was really lovely. So I think it's reminding myself of those things too, like the little messages that you get from friends who aren't doing things publicly and they're not posting like pretty pictures on Instagram or whatever. They're just sending a little message that says like, I'm still awake, or I've deleted all the data off my phone because you freaked me out, or, you know, all those kind of things.
That's super nice. Now, I almost wanted to save this one for when we do some actual proper interviews on the Mother Fault. I am the only person in Australia that has not read the book in preparation.
That is not true, but I am really excited about this.
But I thought I'd slip this in here anyway. I was on Twitter. There was a really good thread that I loved about recurring themes in people's work. So you said your recurring themes, autonomy, women's desire as power, and oceany things. Can we talk about these?
Well, we can, but I didn't think anyone would ever repeat them back to me, Catherine, doing your research. Can I also say, I find these things, like chain letters, deeply intimidating whenever people post them and tag me. But I am, you know, a pleaser, so I answer them. But it's really hard because you're obviously trying to be, like, clever and
all those things. Were these themes difficult to come at? Was one easy to come at?
They were difficult to come at when I was thinking about the fact that that they recur in my work. So, like, thinking about being up to number two and then three – and thinking, oh, how many of them? And in fact, oceany things, like my next book, which is like deep in the industrial heartland of Melbourne, it's a stretch to fit in the ocean, but I have already, you know, I haven't even finished the first draft, but I got her in.
That's interesting too, because your middle grade, is it middle grade? Also featured.
Oh, yes, that is so
ocean. You even get it in very
That is so
early.
Oceany.
And yet oceany is the most ambiguous of all the themes, isn't it?
Because I couldn't quite work it out. I think the desire and power is easy, and you and I have spoken about this before, I'm sure. It was easy in skylarking. I always talk about it with young women when I'm speaking in schools about skylarking. It's really clearly there in The Mother Fault. It's there again in book three. I'm interested in when women first gain power in understanding themselves as, you know, sexual and desirable beings, and then when they either give it up or lose it or feel like they don't have it. I'm interested in all those things. But it just struck me also that I wonder, I think I'll write about it forever, but I wonder how it will change the way I write about it as I age as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. You
know, that might be interesting. I love being in a position to start thinking about, okay, like, I really want to do this for a long time. I wonder how many of these themes are going to recur all the way through. Like, what about for you? What would you say are yours?
I did think about that. I came up with two quickly. One is loneliness. The other is competition and like ambition, but sometimes misplaced ambition. That kind of thing. Thinking about the themes that you raised, just because The Mother Fault's very current, have people repeated them back to you?
Yes. I think they have. I think that themes haven't surprised me because remember that it was like our last time at Musk, maybe last year, and I did a really big kind of, it was when I was redrafting, I had Pippa on board. So she'd done a read and we were getting it ready to send out. And I did kind of a big redraft on the floor and I really did the themes hard. Like, I had them written down. I kind of had grouped everything like about seeing and power and, you know, the geological stuff and borders and, you know, I'd really done it. And I think nothing surprises me when people come back to me at it, and also because of course how odd it's been in terms of authoritarianism and surveillance.
It's very timely
at this particular point in global history. What has surprised me is the bits that people pick out, or the characters, or the scenes, which you know, those scenes which, like, they're not on your radar as key scenes,
or, and then little moments or something that you're even thinking of cutting.
Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or that you know, someone says something and you're like looking and going, shit, I don't know what page that's on, or I don't recall that at all. Who is that person? Which I think is that lovely thing about what it reflects of the reader as well, you know, how much they bring to it.
It's true. So, slightly different note, Do you want to trade interesting things?
I always want to trade interesting things with you, Catherine.
You can go first. You can have an interesting thing. What interesting things do you know?
I'm going to tell you this interesting thing. Of course, mine come from the books that I'm reading because I'm a big nerd. Catherine McKinnon, who wrote Storyland, she recommended this book. It's called Light the Dark, Writers on Creativity, Inspiration and the Artistic Process. And it's very cool. It's like writers talking about one, like a sentence or a piece of poetry that has changed them as a writer. And then they go on to talk about.
That's cool.
So it's very cool. But the thing that stuck out to me in there, there's a great chapter by David Mitchell. And I, you know, am a big David Mitchell fan.
Cloud Atlas? Is he Cloud Atlas?
Yes.
No. Yes. Yes.
But that's such a good book. I haven't read the new one. It seems very big. Anyway, he says in his chapter, you've only got time to be a halfway decent parent and one other thing. And for me, that thing is being a writer. And it's all about, like, you know, how the discipline of, you know, basically you just got to like stumble to the laptop, open the Word document and get cracking. Like that's the only thing. And there was such freedom in that. I'm like, yeah, okay, clearly you're a bloke and I don't know how old your kids are and you, I don't know, think that you're in lockdown right now homeschooling them, but.
It's a lot of qualifications here.
A lot of qualifications. But that idea of, okay, I don't even have to be a brilliant parent. I'm going to recognize that I only have to be a halfway decent parent and one other thing. Like not trying to be an ace partner or a brilliant daughter.
I feel like that's achievable.
Yeah.
But it's like only try hard at one thing.
Yeah.
Or recognize
it. I think it's indicative. Yeah. I mean, on the other side, if I was feeling like not as generous towards Mitchell, I might say, well, clearly that's how you're pushing out so many books, mate, because you're only being a halfway decent parent and a writer. Like, there's not a lot else on your plate there.
I do think that applies to paid work sometimes when you write. Like I think Robert Lucan, I can't remember if I asked him on air or off air, but a question about, oh, you have a very professional job. Like you're really good at something else professional. He was sort of saying, it's surprising that I have a professional job given sort of the implication was that I'm not picking that as my one good thing.
I love that. Yeah, anyway, I highly recommend the book. There's some really good juicy bits in there.
Nice.
So, trade me an interesting thing from your world.
Interesting thing. Well, this is from a recommendation that McKinley Valentine gave us.
Nice.
Jack Druce's newsletter.
I haven't
subscribed
yet.
Started reading.
Tell me why I should.
Really, really good. So he talks about how recently he has had a spike in people subscribing to his newsletter.
Clearly because McKinley Valentine.
Well, I think
mentioned it on our podcast.
Wow, exactly. We'll claim full credit for that, Jack. Okay, so this is what he writes. When I started this, the only subscribers were people I knew in real life. It's hard to be vulnerable and honest when a high percentage of readers are work acquaintances or people you went to school with. You feel like you need to be a particular version of yourself. I'm all for sharing your inner world, but not if there is any risk of a follow-up conversation. It's like stand-up. People think big crowds are intimidating, but that's because they've never played small crowds. The clear eye contact with individual audience members after every joke. If there are 12 people at a show and two of them start talking, you've lost a meaningful portion of the crowd. There's a real pressure to please individuals because they have so much control over how successful the show will be. I've performed to crowds of over 1,000 people a few times. I'm nervous before the show, but on stage there is a calm feeling of being alone. No pressure to bend to the whims of individual audience members. It's just you and the void. There is no need to change who you are because the void won't tell you who it wants you to be.
Oh, that's
good. I loved it. I love that idea of if you've ever done blogs or anything like that, that knowing the 10 people in your audience is a really paralyzing thing, and it's easier to have an anonymous readership or audience in general, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. I think that, did you find that when your book went out into the world that you were more stressed about the response
the most
from people?
Stress. Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
Because they take it personally as well. So interesting. That's really funny. So my next interesting thing has also got 1,000 in it, and it is from your Tools of Titans.
Oh, I'm obsessed.
Which you are obsessed with. And it's that whole section on the of Kevin Kelly's 1,000 True Fans. You only need 1,000 True Fans. And this came at an excellent time. I have actually shared this with a number of people privately on Twitter as well, because it was the Goodreads day when I picked up this, you know, pulled myself from my fetal position on the floor and read this section. And the basic premise of it is that this Kevin Kelly says, you know, you only need 1,000 true fans. Now, to a novelist, a literary novelist, like that might seem like a stretch that you'll ever make 1,000 true fans. But, you know, thinking about it like that, even to these big, extraordinary billionaire type people, you know, you only need that many because they do the work of any other fans. And also thinking about the maths of it. And in that, you know, then you're going to 10% of that number are going to be haters. So there's going to be 100 people for every 1,000 who love you who are going to hate what you do.
Name your 100 by name.
Right now, it's a separate episode. I will be naming the haters. No. But it was, that was also liberating as David Mitchell's stuff, because I was like, you know, that all that stuff that I said way back in those naive episodes when I was like, I'm going to respond to every single person who reaches out to me this time and all that stuff.
Why have you not? Is that, were you trying?
I've really tried to. I have really tried to, particularly with the private messages, because I was like, that's where my energy needs to go. Not scrolling Goodreads to find the one-star review.
That's true.
It needs to go into the people who
have a very good way of thinking about it.
You know, have got what I'm doing. They are the readers. They're the people. You know, when people say to you, the book will find its readers, well, that's what they mean.
Yes.
And they're the people that you give the energy to.
That's a very good point.
Just we'll put a link in the show notes, but it is Catherine's tome that she recommends, Tools of Titans.
You see it everywhere now. I just bought skincare from Zoe Foster Blake.
Zoe,
that's where I'm at. I'm no longer buying clothing because everything is – you just shouldn't buy clothing online, should you? Like it's just one disaster after another.
It really is.
What is going on?
Tell me, is Zoe Foster Blake your other interesting thing?
So there's in Tools of Titans, Derek Silver talks – I think it's Derek Silver or Slither or something – talks about something he created and he was shipping lots of things out to people. It was some music-related thing. And he, purely to amuse himself one day, rather than created the email that went to people to say your thing's being shipped, just did this funny like, we've put white gloves on and carefully extracted your music and we've played it, you know, a really kind of funny, quirky thing that I'm giving no justice to. But I know that Zoe Foster Blake is a fan of Tool of Titans. And if you read all the wording on her packaging,
oh my God. She
has very taken that lesson, or the lesson that he conveys in this book around.
That's so interesting.
Taking minor moments as opportunities and how effective that is.
Because you really do feel like you've done an amazing thing when you order you go to, because
exactly.
You get a big old pat on the back.
Exactly. And even the instructions are actually quite entertaining.
Oh, my gosh. She's a good one. Zoe, we want to talk to you. All right, tell us. We've got to say goodbye to something. It's the end.
Oh, no. I've got one more interesting thing.
I'll go.
Super quick. Caitlin Moran, the UK feminist writer, has a book out called More Than a Woman. Haven't read it yet, but I did read a review, and in it she talks about if she wants children and a job, a woman's life is only as good as the man or woman she marries. That's the biggest truth I know. All too often, women marry their glass ceiling.
Oh.
Such an interesting idea. Probably like quite an established thing that the person in your relationship facilitates things or doesn't. But, oh, my God, it's had me looking around at everybody around me's relationship and evaluating how things work. And I love
that.
That's
so interesting. I love Caitlin Moran.
Yeah, she's good.
I really want this book.
Yeah.
How could we get Caitlin Moran on the show, do you think?
With difficulty. Well, your book's going to come out in the UK soon. Maybe she'll write to you as a number one super fan.
Yeah, Caitlin and Zoe, just anytime you want to touch base with us.
Open invite.
Yeah. Slide into our DMs.
It sounds a bit vulgar to me. I don't really understand.
really does. It's also because everyone says it ironically but truthfully, and so it's just everyone does it with a leering kind of, but they mean it. It's weird.
Before we get into today's interview, we have a new section for the podcast. Charlotte Wood almost needs no introduction, but I'll give her one anyway. She is the award-winning writer of 5 novels and 2 non-fiction works, including The Writer's Room, which is all about the creative process. She's also our new resident agony aunt. Charlotte's going to be here each episode answering any questions you have about writing. Honestly, the juicier the better. So if you want to send in a question, the address is hosts@thefirsttimepodcast.com. And now, this week's question. Dear Agony Aunt, what would you do if you were asked to write a puff for a book you thought was bad? What if the writer is a friend? What if they're not? Yours sincerely, Puffy Blurb.
Hello, Puffy Blurb. This is such a vexed issue. There's one very short answer, and that is that I personally would never write a puff for a book that I thought was bad. The long answer is that this whole thing of being asked for blurbs and puffs is an absolutely excruciatingly vexed issue, and it's become the bane of my life, quite frankly. So I thought I could just have a little moment to just politely set out the difficulties with blurbs. First off, and this is a really personal view that I don't think any publisher would share with me, but I actually don't believe that blurbs make much difference at all to readers. I really don't. It's certainly not going to make or break a book. You know, often you see a blurb by an incredible, you know, world-leading author, and it just doesn't follow that that book then just, you know, goes stratospherically upwards. And of course, you know, a publisher would say, but it might get someone to stop and pick it up. And, you know, maybe that's true. But to me, and the other problem with blurbs these days is that a book doesn't just have to have one blurb. It has to have like 10 blurbs from 10 different writers. And to me, frankly, the higher the number of blurbs, the more insecure the publisher looks about this book. But I do understand that this is a very old-fashioned view, and you know, it's not really going to hold water with publishers these days, and it is almost impossible to ask a publisher not to bother with blurbs. My first 4 novels had no endorsements, no puffs or blurbs at all, but I understand that the world has changed, and yeah, it's something we've got to deal with. I'm also a hypocrite, because especially internationally, I have had some incredibly generous blurbs written for my books. And I really do appreciate every single author who's done this for me. But I would never ask for it myself, and I would never, ever expect it from anybody. So at the moment, like, I know writers of one book will probably already have been asked to write blurbs for their fellow authors. And the more books you write, the more you get asked. So I'm now approached about once a week to blurb a book nearing publication. Last week it was 3. I always say no now, because I have a pretty strict policy of not writing what I call solicited endorsement. So if someone asks me for one, I just have a blanket policy of, sorry, I don't do them. Occasionally I will offer one for someone I know who has a book coming out, and I've done that a number of times this year for writers whose books I've either read in draft form or for writers who I just know that I'm going to love their work because of the work they've done before. For a long time, though, I just said no to everyone, absolutely everyone, including a couple of my very, very closest friends whose books I loved. And it was just very hard to say no. I know there'll be people listening to this who asked me for blurbs and I've said no, and I just want you to know that it's not you, it's everyone. I hate saying no, but I just have to for all kinds of reasons, including that someone who puffs books too often really loses all their credibility, I think, very quickly. And another really big reason for me is I really hate having my reading colonized by other people's demands. Especially when I'm writing a new book, I just need to read what I need to read without having to have a stack of required reading near me. So the only way that I have found that's fair is to say no to everyone, and then I make a very few exceptions. And I can tell you that having done too many this year, even with my ironclad policy, I'm going to be doing none next year at all. I also think it's kind of rude of publishers to get writers to approach people for blurbs for their books. I think it's really kind of mean. It's fun if, unless you know the person really well, if they're a friend of yours, another writer who you know well, okay, but it puts you in a difficult position. And frankly, I think that kind of thing of approaching people for publicity endorsements is the job of the publisher, not the writer. So if you have the strength to push back on that, if your publisher tells you you have to go around and get blurbs from people, I would push back if I could. It's one thing if your publisher wants to ask people for blurbs, but it's quite a different thing to send you out into the world, you know, begging. It's a horrible feeling. I mean, I've actually never done it. But the idea of doing it just fills me with horror. So I certainly don't ask for blurbs myself, and I don't expect them from anybody. But I do think, don't blurb a book that's bad, because it's your name that you're risking there. It's your reputation. So I think the ideal way to deal with it is to get yourself a policy very, very quickly. Some writers say, I only do two a year. Some say, I only do them for new writers. Some say, I only do them for, you know, my publishing house or whatever. So there's so much complexity in the whole issue of blurbs that I just wish it would go away. But thank you, Puffy Blurb, for giving me the opportunity to have that rant. And, I hope you find a way to deal with it.
Sam Coley is a writer living in Sydney. His two favourite things in the world are taking photographs and dancing. Coley's debut novel, State Highway 1, was the winner of the 2017 Richel Prize for Emerging Writers. We recorded this interview via Zoom just prior to State Highway 1 hitting shelves in 2020. Sam Coley, welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's so good to be speaking to you just before your debut novel, State Highway 1, hits shelves, because it means we get all the feels, and that's the spot that I want to be in. I want to begin by asking, we know that you call it quite a lot of places home, and that's probably quite difficult right now in the middle of COVID. Where are you speaking to us from today?
I'm in Sydney today.
Okay. So you can still move around.
To a degree. I've been here since January 2019, so just over a year and a half.
Okay. And how are you going with the COVID stuff in general, Sam?
It's difficult. I miss my friends. I'm a very go out and see, you know, I'm happiest when I'm with my friends and family. I think I have to be distracted from constant existential crisis. So I need like a lot of distraction from people. And my way of blowing off steam is to just get blotto and go dance it out in a nightclub. And I can't do either of those things. It's really
oh, that's so hard.
Yeah.
Catherine and I have talked about this because I think I said it in one of the podcasts recently that I wanted to be squishy with people. Like, I miss being squishy.
Yeah, I just want to, yeah, that's it. I want to be sweaty and, like, dancing. I think I said, you know, when this whole thing is over, I am just going to run to a nightclub, order 100 drinks, and I'm going to kiss everybody in the bar on the mouth.
That sounds incredible. Everyone stay tuned for when Sam's going to do that.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, obviously releasing a book into a pandemic was not part of the plan. How are you feeling about release right now?
Oh, okay. I think it's been very up and down. When my editor sent me an email to say, oh, just so you know, it's gone to print, I immediately stopped sleeping. And for about a week, I was just like lying in bed thinking, oh, like, oh shit, it's actually coming out. And I can't do anything about it anymore, because I'd been making changes like literally up to the day before that email, which I didn't realize was a thing. And so not being able to change, and then I'm very much an overthinker. So I have taken that book apart and put it back together from every possible angle, and that was all I was doing. It was really all I was doing. It was very, and I think now, you know, a few people have read it. There's been some good reviews, early reviews, and I'm feeling a bit better about it, but I'm sure it will, you know, it comes out in a week. So I'm sure that this week is going to be a stressful one. Yeah.
Yeah. Stick with it. It's a, it's such a wonderful book, and we'll talk a little bit about, I'm so interested to know about the process of you taking apart and putting it together, and we'll talk a bit about that, but let's go back first. Sam, when did you first see your words in print?
Oh,
as a kid at school.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I wrote this. we had student teachers come in when I must have been about 5 or 6. And we had student teachers come into primary school. And so I wrote this like book called I Remember. And it was about things that obviously I was just making up. And pretending that one of them was about when my older sister was born by cesarean section. So I wrote about how I remembered that the doctor had to like cut my mum open, and I drew this picture, you know, all in orange highlighter, I think, of like a doctor with a chainsaw standing over.
Oh, I love this.
And my mum still got it, you know, it's like, it's 3 pages long or something. And yeah, it's, so that's my first published. It was laminated, and it was typed down on a computer, which at that time was like a big deal.
And Sam, did it get the reaction that you were after? Did it entertain and delight?
I think it probably confused me. But it has continued to delight and entertain people going forward. The student teacher wrote a little bio of me, which maybe I should, if I have to revise it, which include the line, Sam is a most persnickety noodle. Which,
I think that's it. That's your tagline forever. Yeah. That's great. So, okay. So an early thrill at telling a story. What happened then? Who were your teachers and inspirations? Were you always a writer?
I guess so. I don't really, we had to write a lot. So I don't know if that was when I was in primary school, we used to write, like, we would have to do this thing called doing a publication. And it was like, you'd have to write probably it was like 6 or 10 pages or something. And we did those a lot. So just by virtue of having to do it all the time. And I read all the time, and I really wanted to write Usborne Puzzle Adventures. I don't know if you ever read those.
I love that.
Yeah. So I used to write my own versions of them with, you know, little stupid clues in the illustrations and mysteries to solve. I was very into like detective stories and ghost stories and stuff. And then I was really lucky with teachers. I think I had mostly all good ones. But when I was in third form, which is what you call
year nine,
I really did badly in my exams at school because I did not pay attention. I just did not care. And I went to a very competitive, like traditional grammar, like an all boys grammar school in Auckland. And, but I did really well in English. And so I got hauled up in front of the dean, and I got detention every day for a week or something. And he said, you should write, he said, well, clearly English is the only thing you're good at. So you should write, you should just write a book. And I was like, well, maybe I will write a book then. And from then on, I continued to not pay attention in class, and I just wrote stories in my exercise books. So, yeah,
I love that so much, Sam. Have you sent a signed copy of State Highway 1 to your principal?
No, I don't. I have no idea where he is. I could probably track him down, but I do thank him in the acknowledgement. So, you know, maybe he'll buy a copy and see his name at the back. Yeah.
I do hope so.
I doubt he remembers me.
Sam, you entered the Ritchell Prize in 2017 and you went on to win it. I want to ask about when you started writing the manuscript that would become State Highway 1 and and what pushed you over the line to enter?
I was in London and I hadn't written anything for it. I wrote a lot, and then in my early 20s, I guess, I got kind of sidetracked by other things, and I went to film school, and I kind of was doing production stuff, and I hadn't written anything. And then I moved to England and I was feeling very creatively stifled. I was like working in an office and not doing anything that interesting. So my ex-boyfriend had bought me a typewriter, because I always used to write on typewriter because I couldn't afford a computer when I was like younger. So I bought this typewriter for like $1.50 and I wrote on that.
I love it.
So he bought me a typewriter and said, you should start writing again. And it sat there for a couple of years. And then at the end of 2015, I don't know, I guess I was in the shower where all the good ideas come from. And the first line just immediately kind of came to me. And so I sat down and started writing.
That's, yeah. I love that, because I can see already that that's such a key point for you. Did you feel it bodily? How did you know, okay, this is a thing? This is actually a thing.
I don't know. I think it's really hard. It's really easy to look back on it now that I can hold a published copy and say, well, I always kind of knew it was going to get published because of, you know, if this was the Never Getting Published podcast, I'd be going, oh, my God. So, you know, but I started writing and I just had a really good feeling about it. And because New Zealanders are obsessed with themselves, and, you know, anytime they say New Zealand on a movie, everybody from New Zealand's like, oh, that's us all, New Zealand, yeah. So I thought, I had the idea and I thought, oh, like, I think this has a decent chance of some commercial interest, because I'd written a novel when I was like between 17 and 18, I think, and it is objectively terrible. but I lived next door to a book critic, like a professional book reviewer, so I sent it to him and he sent me back some very nice, gentle, like, this is good writing, but it is completely bonkers and nobody would ever publish it. So maybe you should go away and write something more normal first. And then, you know, so this was my attempt at writing something a bit more straightforward.
So did you write from top to bottom? So that you're saying that was 2015. You obviously have something to enter in 2017. Was it done?
No, God, no. I like partying too much. So I was writing like 2 pages a month or something. So,
okay, wow.
Between 2015 and 2017, when I entered the ritual, I'd written 35,000 words over the course of those 2 years. I was very much I've got nothing to do tonight, so why don't I do some writing? I never made time for it. But it was mostly, I think when I decided to enter the ritual, I had to go back and fill in some chapters, which was a pain because I was like, oh, now how do I get them from here to here? And with that pressure, it was a bit more difficult. But after that, so then I had 35,000. I entered about 20,000 into the ritual. And then subsequently, I wrote like 90,000 more words in the next 8 months, because that was when I was like, oh, I really should make a go of this writing thing. I think maybe I'll be good at it.
So, Sam, that moment entering, because I know that lots of our listeners, you know, both enter prizes like the ritual and other prizes, and that there's always that tension between, oh, do I just throw my hands up in the air and do it, or do I wait until I've got something perfect? What pushed you over the edge? How did you know about it? Why did you enter?
So I was living in Adelaide at the time, and I was part of a writer's group, and actually it was somebody at the writer's group, like, mentioned it to me. And I had just finished doing an online course run by Curtis Brown in the UK called Finish Your Novel. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that course, everybody submitted, I think, about 2,000 words, and then one got picked, and you got to have a Skype date with an agent from Curtis Brown. And so my extract got picked. So I was feeling very confident, I guess, and because, you know, writing is such a weird thing. You don't show it to many people, and the people you do show it to tend to have a vested interest in keeping you happy anyway. So,
of course,
I was like, oh, is this any good? And so I got this good result, and I thought, why not? I didn't really get that the Ritual Prize was a big deal. And like,
which was probably good in terms of your entering it.
Yeah, I really didn't. I just heard about it through, you know, someone at my writing group. I was like, oh, great. You only have to enter 3 chapters. I haven't even finished the book yet. I spent about 2 months like really working on those 3 chapters. I didn't just like push control P and throw it in, but I just thought, oh, well, why not? Like, it's free to enter. It's, you know, let's see what happens.
Yeah. Okay, so fast forward to the moment when you find out that you have won the prize. Tell me about that moment.
Yeah, it was very weird. Again, there's a theme of insomnia here because I saw my name on the shortlist, and then I immediately stopped sleeping, and I would just, my poor boyfriend, like I would pace around the house being like, what if I win? What if I don't win? What about this? And then, so Robert Watkins at Hachette, he called me, and my parents happened to be visiting for a week. So I was just kind of walking around Adelaide with them, and then I got this phone call out of the blue, and it was about half an hour, and I think I was just walking in circles around this like antique shop somewhere in the city, just like pacing, and they figured out what the call was about. And it was really, you know, it was actually great that my parents were there by coincidence, because we're quite close as a family. And so they were like, let's take you out to dinner. And I was like,
love it.
Yes, please. But then I just felt like someone was going to take it away. Like they were going to call back 15 minutes later and say, we're so sorry, we've made a terrible mistake, you're not the winner. Or on the night they were going to say, actually, we told everybody they were the winner, so they'd all write a speech.
Oh, Sam.
And just honestly, and again, my poor boyfriend, the long-suffering guy, I think I was more anxious after I found out that I won than I was when I hadn't, because I was just like, oh, what about this? What about that? Oh, just that. So really, until I was literally holding the award trophy and a check for $10,000 in my hand, that's when it really sunk in. When I got to the event in Sydney, I kind of looked around and I was like, I think this is maybe more of a big deal than I was letting myself think it was. So that was really, it was great at that point.
I want to ask two things stemming from that, because I think that a lot of people will relate to that feeling of anxiety of just like, you know, this can't be really happening and it's all going to go to shit. Have you been able to use any strategies to keep that feeling at bay? Like, did it go away, or is it just morphed into different kind of versions?
I wish I could give you a really good answer about mindfulness and yoga, but honestly, I find it just transfers itself onto the next thing. So I was stressed about the prize. And then once I'd written it, I started thinking, well, what if only those first 3 chapters were any good? What if you know, because everybody says anybody can start a novel, you know, the real work is having to finish it. And the middle is, I guess, I don't know, I've only written one, but the middle was where it tends to be hard. And so I was just thinking, oh, great, you'll never finish, or you'll finish, but it'll be terrible. And then when I finished and it got acquired by Hachette, then I started thinking, then it became like, well, you'll never survive the edit. And I almost didn't. And then, you know, and then it was like, oh, great, it's going to come out, but people are going to hate it. And I'm not a metaphors person. I'm not good with that stuff. And I literally had dreams where like people would be chasing me down the street, hurling copies of my book at my head. Seriously. And I woke up and I was like, well, I know what that was about. And it's such a weird process. And I think when I do what I do to try and mitigate it a bit is just think, next time, fingers crossed, this won't be new, and you'll know how you're supposed to feel, and you'll have that experience to look back on. So I just keep thinking, I can't wait to write another book. And I just feel like it's going to be easier because you know how you're supposed to feel about the editing process, or, you know, all that stuff. So that kind of keeps me safe.
Sam, the other thing that happened at that party, and I know this because I listened to you in conversation at the Emerging Writers Festival, is that you met your agent.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that and how your agent has helped you navigate the next part of the journey?
Yeah. Well, I met my agent's Grace Heifetz at Left Bank, and she was at the Ritual Prize party, and I think it was probably Robert or somebody from Hachette that introduced me, and she was there with a colleague of hers, and they said, "Oh, this is Grace from Curtis Brown." And I said, "Oh, Curtis Brown, I did an online writing course from Curtis Brown in the UK, and I talked to an agent, and I remembered her, and I said, "Oh, Nora Perkins from Curtis Brown UK," and she told me to get in touch with an agent at Curtis Brown, you know, because Australia and stuff, and I had this name written down in my notebook, I couldn't remember it, and Grace said, "It was probably me," and I was like, "Oh, maybe, that sounds about right." So we kind of connected that way. And then I went back to Adelaide after the thing, and I found my notes from that Skype call, and I had Grace's name written down. So I just emailed her and said, "Oh, look, there it is." And I sent her the three chapters that I'd entered for the Ritual, and she read them, and she said, "Great, get on board." And I kind of thought, I took a step back, and I was like, "I actually just want to finish the book first." So then, you know, fast forward a year, I finished the draft and I found the old email from a year ago, and I said, "How's a year gone by already?" So I sent it to her, and she, you know, she loved it, and it's been great. And she was at Curtis Brown, and then, sorry, she's at Left Bank now. So about 5 minutes after I signed with her, she called me to say, "Oh, just so you know, I'm leaving Curtis Brown and I'm starting my own agency," which was great. And I'm really glad that I stuck with her. She's excellent, and she always talks me off the ledge. I'm always wound up about stuff, and from the cover to the, I don't know, the font. I'm a very picky person. I always call myself a picky bitch. And so I will call her and I'll be like, "Is this something I'm supposed to be mad about, or, you know, not?" And she's like, "Just calm down a bit, and blah, blah, blah. And this is, you know, this is where we can win, and this is where we just have to like let things go." And it's really great to have someone to bounce off that you don't feel like they're gonna yank your book away from you. Yeah. If you piss them off. Yeah
That's and that sounds exactly like when people have talked about their agents as a sounding board. It's just one of those yeah, the wonderful things that you get when you have an agent in between you and the publisher.
Through a friend of a friend in the UK, I ended up having breakfast with Melina Marchetta. And I wasn't agented at the time, but I thought I was probably going to get an acquisition deal. So I emailed her and I said, "Look, we met for coffee in Adelaide when you were there for the Writers Festival. Can you talk, like, do you have time?" She's incredibly generous and the nicest person. And she had breakfast with me and said, "You know, this is what to expect, and this is kind of how the publishing process looks, and this and that." And she said, "Do you have an agent?" And I said, "Oh, no, I'm not sure. Like, you know, I'm pretty good at reading contracts. I've studied, you know, this and that, and I've worked in the law and that." And she basically just whacked me across the face and said, "Get an agent. Go get one now. You are stupid if you don't get one. Get it. Call her. Go home. You know, if you already have a connection at Curtis Brown, you go home and you email her immediately." And I thought, "Oh, okay, all right, I guess I better."
If Melina Marchetta tells me, I will do it.
Exactly. So, yeah.
Sam, the other thing that you did when you won the prize is that you took your cash and you flew to New Zealand to do the trip that Alex and Amy take in State Highway 1. What was that like, and how did you record your research?
It was incredible. It was, you know, it was a part of the country that I've seen before. Oh, sorry. The South Island I've seen before, but not for a long time. So it was amazing. It was weird doing it by myself, but thankfully I have friends and family scattered around the country that, I managed to do. I would do like one night by myself, and then the next night I would be with somebody that I knew. It was very fast. It was, I think, 11 days or something. So it was much quicker than the trip. And I did a lot of driving, and I slept in the car because I am an idiot. And I got to like this beautiful lake, dark sky reserve thing it was like the day before New Year's Eve. And I just thought, I'll just book a hotel. I'll just get on my phone and book a hotel. Obviously nothing was available. So I was like, I'll just sleep in the car. It's fine. And I took loads and loads of notes. I took thousands of photos, and I actually used my cell phone as a, like, with the voice recorder, which is kind of hilarious because I was recording these voice memos being like, oh, the rolling hills and the sea and all this kind of rubbish, and little ideas as they came to me, and then I would write them up when I got to where I was going. And on the section between Christchurch and Tekapo, I managed to get out of sync with the click it like this, you know, on and off. And so when I thought I was recording, I wasn't. And when I thought I wasn't recording, I was. So I got to Tekapo and I went to listen. And it's literally like the first two were okay. And then it's just road noise and me singing along to Lord. Full volume.
Oh, that is so great. I hope you kept that. I hope you kept those.
It'll be there somewhere. I keep everything. But like, and then I was like, well, yeah, I'll never know what I lost, but it's fine. It was a very funny thing.
It's so incredibly evocative. And I don't know whether it was made more evocative to me because I am in lockdown and desperate to get out and see landscape and ocean, but I just I really couldn't shake the feeling of the trip, and not in a bad way, for quite a number of days after I finished reading it. So whatever you did in that research trip, you absolutely totally nailed it. So it takes another year then before you finished, then goes to acquisition, then what happens?
So I won the prize in November 2017, and then I finished the draft by, I think, the end of July 2018. But I draft longhand and on a typewriter. So then I have to transcribe everything that I've written. So it was another couple of months before I had a computerized version of the draft. Then it went to acquisition. So then I spent time, what I do is print everything off. I'm sorry, trees, but I print everything off and I get a four-color pen and I just go through and mark up the entire book with using a color-coded system. So it's green it's pretty obvious.
No, please tell us. I am so into this.
So it's green if I'm happy. So I'll underline something or circle something or just put a tick if I'm happy. If it's must be changed, I'll use red. So I either cross a word out or underline a whole sentence or circle a paragraph or whatever. If it's notes to myself, then they go in blue. And if it's actual changes to the text, like word substitutions or writing lines, then that goes in black. So that's what I do. And I've done that at every stage of the editing process. So I moved to Sydney and we had no internet, we had no furniture, and I was just like sitting on a fold-out couch with pages strewn around me in the lead up to March, you know, crossing out and ticking and things. And I just, if there's a section that I think needs particular work, I will just go to Officeworks, print it off, get out my four-color pen and work through it until there's more green than, you know, than not.
And at this stage, are you doing that just on your own reading? Like, you've not got anyone else giving you feedback at this stage?
So I have a writing partner that I work with in London. We met through a writers group, and so we send each other stuff back. Well, I thank her in the notes, and honestly, it would be a completely different book if not for her input. She's very good at spotting where things can change and stuff. So I think I was sending... By that stage, I was pretty much working by myself because at some point I just need to only listen to my own thoughts. But certainly during the drafting, when I was like, oh, I'm not sure about this or whatever, I would send it to her in Google Docs, and then she would kind of comment it up and I would change things and say, oh, what do you think about this? So we were, together a lot, and she's great. And then working, you know, working with editors after the acquisition was a strange process for the first time.
You said before, Sam, at the top of the interview, you said you nearly didn't make it out. You nearly didn't survive editing. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
I feel like it's such a shtick, but I really do find writing difficult. It's not something that comes easily to me. I tend to be very hard on myself while I'm writing, and I think everything is rubbish. And I'm such a it's such a cliche of a tortured creative, but I really just don't feel good about it. And I think I tend to be quite adversarial in jobs that I have. I'm either advocating for or against or kind of fighting with people all the time. So, I think some of it comes from the way I approach text sometimes, and it's 100% the wrong approach, but I sometimes look at things with that. And I think this comes from being adversarial, is I go to a text and think, what's wrong with this and what holes can I pick in it? And when I said earlier about taking it apart and putting it back together again, that's that kind of attitude. And because I do that, I expect that everybody else is doing that as well. And a lot of my non-sleeping over the release is, you know, comes from my thinking that when someone picks that book up off the shelf, they open it and think, what's wrong with it? I'm going to circle all the bits that I don't like and, you know, and tell you why you're a terrible writer. So when I came to the edit, it was really, you know, I felt it took me a while to get over the fact that actually that person was there to make the book better, not to tell me that I was no good. Mm. But it coincided with a particularly horrific time at my day job. So I was tired and strung out and just like not in the mood for it. And I actually did a structural edit first, which was very strange. And then two rounds of copy editing, which I think was, by the end of that was February this year when I was finished with the second copy edit, and I was just very exhausted. And I think sometimes I just was like, oh, I've reached the end of my capability as a writer. This is as far as I can go. And also because I didn't know how to edit. I'd never really edited anything before. And I was Googling, how do you edit a book? Like what practically do you do? Do you print it all off and compare two pages? Do you put two documents up on the computer? Do you do a thing in track change? Like how actually practically do you manage that process? And so for the first week probably of, especially of the structural edit, it was me figuring out what my process is, because I'd only drafted before and I knew how to draft, but I didn't know how to edit, and it was a completely different skill.
Now, look, we do absolutely no spoilers in this show, but I think we can talk about this without giving anything away. There's a real structural elegance to this book, and a through line and a story question that really keeps the reader on the edge of their seat right till the end. I want to know if you modelled this element of the book on any other books. And now I realise you saying as a young person, those Usborne puzzle books, which is such a great hint. And did you have to work really hard to get that part right?
No, I didn't have to, or maybe I did. I don't know. Ask my editor. I think I did have to work a bit, but I knew about the convergence at the end, and there's actually a book. It was the first. It's called Invisible Monsters by Chuck Palahniuk. I was a very, you know, angry, young, white teenager. You know, I read a lot of Bret Easton Ellis and Chuck Palahniuk and all those kind of like those idiots. And I'd mostly been reading like Goosebumps and teen fantasy and stuff. So I read Invisible Monsters, and it was the first really contemporary novel that I ever read. And blew my head open. I'd never encountered an unreliable narrator before. I was like, oh my God, like what is this? And you don't have to tell a story in order for it to make sense. And things that happen in the future happen in the, I was, ah! And I think I read it like four times in a row. I was just like, oh, and there's little clues about this and that. And then when you read it for a second time, all of a sudden it makes way more sense than it did the time before. And I just kind of, it wasn't that I was trying, obviously I'm going to say I wasn't trying to emulate that novel, but I think that start, that way, that kind of non-linear, I like any books that kind of play with the conventions of what we expect from a novel. And as long as it is informing the story, not just a gimmick for gimmick's sake, but I'm a sucker for that kind of stuff. And so I think if I'd told the story in a straightforward way, it would be really boring, yeah. Boring and no good, which is good for me because I'm not good at story. It's not something that I think it's not my particular strength. I find plotting quite difficult, and so it was easy for me to write a road trip book because I literally have a map of New Zealand in front of my desk, and I just drew a line down it and I said, these are where the story points are going to happen. And so I feel like I kind of tricked the reader a little bit, like by kind of having these moments occur simultaneously or side by side, that on their own might not stand.
Well, I totally encourage for listeners who have not got their hand on a copy yet, I encourage you to go and read it, then come back and listen to this very particular answer again, because Sam, I promise you, like you say then, you know, you don't do story very well. Like I have not gasped out loud and turned to my partner in the bed and gone, oh my gosh, I think this is happening. And then just been so deeply satisfied by the reading. So you certainly gave me that. Sam, I was really reminded of Victoria Hannon's new book, Kokomo, when I was reading State Highway 1. And it was specifically this kind of push me, pull me tug of home and away and the places where we can become fully ourselves and also the complexities of family. I know that you've called many places home. Mm. How did your own experience inform Alex's experiences in the novel?
In terms of that sense of figuring out what home was, I actually I'd been living in London since 2010, and I went home for the first time. I went home to New Zealand for the first time at the beginning of 2014. So I'd been away for about 3.5 years. And I always had this idea that New Zealand was my home and that England was just somewhere I was living for a while. And I treated it very temporarily when I was there. I was like, oh, I'm here for a while. I'll leave as soon as I get bored. It's just, you know, somewhere to have fun. And it was when I went back to New Zealand, because I'm a, you know, contrarian dickhead or whatever. So when I was in New Zealand and I was like, oh, it's so nice to be home. And I would talk about England and use that word home. And, you know, I'd say, oh, I'm going home in 2 weeks or whatever. And I found that certain friends of mine and family members got a bit defensive over me calling England my home, and they said, no, England's not your home, this is your home, you're home now. And there was this weird possessive idea that you know, and for me it was just a word, I wasn't really attaching significance to it. But then because of that reaction, I did have this kind of deep think about it. And so when I started writing State Highway 1, I was kind of thinking, okay, well, why would you do a road trip of New Zealand? I knew it was going to be a road trip. I thought, because it started as a book of photography in my head. And because I like taking photos, I take them all the time. And I thought, oh, I'm going to do this book of photography down State Highway 1. And then I thought, oh, I'm going to, blah, and then I'm going to fictionalize it. And then I thought, oh, that's way more interesting. And I can do it from my living room. I don't even have to go. So it's easy and cheap. I think I got off point. So I started thinking about why would two people, and who would they be, and why would they do a road trip, and why would you suddenly have to go home if you'd kind of said that you'd never go back. And then I guess because of that having happened the previous year, I kind of decided that I wanted to make that a central idea, because I had gone through that process of thinking, okay, well, where is my home? And now I just feel like it's, yeah, as you said, I call a lot of places home, and that's totally fine with me. And they're all different homes and they're all have different things, but there's nowhere that I look at and think, I'd never go back there. I've no interest in ever going there again.
Tell me about your approach to social media. Have you got people that you're modeling your strategies on, or are you just whatever?
No, sorry, I don't have a social media strategy. I just get drunk and send tweets out at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Look, it's working for Susan Orlean, so I think it can work for you.
No, to kind of go back to that anxiety about the the book suddenly getting yanked away or whatever. And you want to talk about fear of getting a book yanked away. Imagine when your publisher calls you and says, we're delaying the release by 3 months. And
yeah. Think of all the things I could do and change more months.
Yeah. And I did. Oh, I did. I was actually really grateful for that time in the end, because I made quite a few changes that I'm happy with. But this is probably not a satisfying answer, but I cannot take it too seriously, because if I do, I'll be too invested. And then if everything goes wrong, I'll be too upset. So I have to keep myself, and maybe that goes back to the strategy of coping, the way I cope, and it's probably not healthy and it's a bit deflective, but like, you know, I had 200 copies turned up at my house to sign, and I had to sign them with ridiculous things like, oh, I try to write a good quote, but somebody's having a fight on the TV in the background and it's too distracting. And they're just like, and then I did like a bad signature. I was like, oh, that signature's terrible. Let me try again. And all this like rubbish. And so the first 200 people who order off Booktopia, you might get some ludicrous piece of...
Oh, I love that so much.
Because I can't think of writing as like a big, serious, like highbrow thing. And that's what, that distance that I keep from it, I think, is what keeps me from getting too, I don't get stressed out about reviews on Goodreads or, you know, whether it's this or it's that. Because it's like, well, it's something I do and I have a day job and blah, blah, blah. So
that seems very, very smart and very, very healthy, Sam. I know that this is your first podcast interview and I'm very thrilled to be the first, but I want to know if there's a question that you are really looking forward to being asked about State Highway 1, maybe one that you haven't been asked yet in interviews. What do you want to talk about when you talk about this book?
No one's asked me about whether the character is like, you know, what, to what degree is it autobiographical? And my answer is that it's whatever, not to any degree that you can separate yourself from somebody that you write about, but certainly. So the parents, for example, are not particularly good parents. I sent copies to my parents about 2 weeks ago and I have not heard from them. And I have this horrible feeling like they've both read it and they've thought, is that what you think?
Oh my gosh, you need to contact them immediately and find out and then tell me.
Because it's first person, you know, because it's first person present. And so I think there's this, and for people who know me and they'll be like, oh, this is what Sam thinks about this. And
oh my gosh, I totally Googled you to see if maybe you had really famous parents.
No, definitely not. I decided to make them famous because when I started writing, they were very normal and they were really like kind of just middle class. And then I always like to make things more complicated. And that is autobiographical. I am always trying to make my life more complicated. Like I moved to Adelaide, I thought, oh, we're gonna work full time, I'm gonna study law full time, I'm gonna write a book. You know, and it was especially because my life in London, I'd finally kind of, I got settled and my money situation was okay and I was in a stable, and I was like, I'm moving to Australia. This is like, I'm bored, I gotta do something else. And so every time I could make things more difficult for Alex and Amy, I did. So I thought, oh, what if the parents weren't just parents, but they were too busy for you and you had a kind of not the best relationship with them in the first place. And how would that complicate the grief that, you know, that you feel? And I think I got off track. Sorry. Oh, autobiographical. No. Yeah. So when I was writing the parents, I actually just thought, what is the opposite of my own parents, you know, what wouldn't my parents do and how wouldn't they treat me or us as a family? And like, I have a very close relationship with my brother and sister. So a lot of that fractiousness between Alex and Amy growing up, I just kind of thought, what's the opposite of what would happen in my life? And I can be very shy. When I first meet people, I tend to be quite withdrawn. I'm really like, I stand in the corner and don't talk to anybody and just want to run away. And then it very quickly, like once I've met someone like twice, I will be loud and, you know, making jokes and all that kind of stuff. And so Alex and Amy are very kind of opposite. And I think when Alex is a bit reticent and quite shy, I tended to go, how would I react in that situation if I was being scared, anxious, shy Sam. And then for Amy, I kind of thought, well, what if I was being loud, two wines and like ridiculous, dance in a fountain in the middle of the night, Sam? And so I kind of pulled myself apart in order to inform those two characters.
I love that. Sam, and I'm doing this and asking this, recognizing that you don't have the benefit of hindsight that many of our guests do, but in the moment that you're in right now, is there any advice that you can give to other emerging writers or debut novelists?
Yes, I do have advice. Someone's obviously probably said it before and said it better, but you know, people always say that creativity is a muscle and you've got to flex it and you've got to exercise it. And I think for me, yes, absolutely. But it's also like a muscle in the sense that you have to rest. And so I have, even deep into the copy edit, I just was like, do you know what I feel like doing today? Playing PlayStation all day and not working on the dumb book. And despite time pressure, despite, you know, feeling like the weight of the world in the eyes of everybody who knows what the Ritual Prize is being on me to do well, just taking, and you know, not even like I'm going to take a date, so I took a whole weekend. I watched all of Goliath season 3 when it came out. I thought, I'm going to watch one episode and then I'll get back to the book. And then like 1 a.m. I was like, that was so good, I just don't care. And not feeling guilty about it, because you just burn out. Like, you can burn out. And I just email and ask for more time. I emailed my editor. I was like, and I really thought I needed an extra week and a half. So I asked for 3 weeks and they came back and said, you can have 10 days. And I was like, yeah, that's great. I think I can do it.
Great advice.
Yeah, rest, man. Like, just if you are up against the wall, I know people who, you know, have to write 1,000 words a day or 5,000 words a day or whatever it is, and are really strict in terms of their writing regime. I'm the exact opposite. I just, if I write a sentence and I got nothing else, I just walk away and think, oh, I'll come back and figure it out later. And there's nothing you can't fix in the edit. There's like, so, you know, draft and draft and draft and draft and do 20 drafts and then don't worry if something's not perfect, because it was a full 15 months between acquisition and my intended release date. And you know, that's like a year and a bit. It will be almost a year and a half since acquisitions when it comes out, so that's a whole extra year and a half of, let's be real, 80% of my brain usually being taken up with thinking about this book. So like, answers come later when you least expect them to.
Great answer. Finally, Sam, can you please recommend us a debut novel anytime, any place?
Yeah, well, I was thinking about it. I'm going to say Kokomo by Victoria Hannon. I know everybody's banging on about it. And I would, as much as I would love to say, oh, you know that book that everybody likes? Well, it's actually no good, and I'll tell you why. It is good. It's really good. It's, you know, it's excellent. Everybody's going on about it. And there's a reason for that. I like that you compared us before. That's
Well, I'm very glad.
But yeah, it's an excellent novel. I was lucky enough to get an advanced copy of it at the end of last year, but it's just come out, so I really look forward to reading it again in its finished form.
And we will be speaking to Victoria before the end of this season, which is very exciting. Sam Coley, you have been a delight to talk to. Thank you so much for speaking with us, and I just wish you all the best for State Highway 1 and its release.
Thanks very much. It's been so much fun. This is, for my first time, it's been excellent. And I've had heaps. Yeah. So if you decide to do the second time podcast.
We'll have you back. We'll have you back in a second.
I'd love to.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website, or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at The First Time Pod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.